Disc golf rules can be pretty simple. Throw your disc from the tee pad, advance to your lie, and throw again, attempting to hole out in as few throws as possible. These simple rules allow anyone to pick up disc golf in just 3 steps, but as anyone who has played a tournament, a bag tag round, or any round where something is on the line knows, it's a lot more complicated than that. Beyond the simpler rules cribbed from ball golf, like tee order, the rules governing disc golf largely have to do with how we manage play using a thrown device that is both ball and club, and with which you can shape beautiful shots through the air. The PDGA official rules of disc golf has gone through 10 major revisions since 1982. These are all listed on their website, and you can find a link to those in this episode's notes. Although in between those major revisions, there have been some minor tweaks in the intervening years. The original official rules of disc golf came from a 1978 sign DGA sold with their courses, and it only included 15 rules for play. But that planted the seed that would become the PDGA rulebook we have today, coming in at 21 pages, covering 14 sections of rules, which include 28 more specific sub-rules, 2 appendices for rules on match play and doubles or team play, as well as the 23-page competition manual for disc golf events. Disc golf is easy to pick up, but difficult to master, as players new and old will tell you. But it isn't just about developing the skills required to throw a disc well in all conditions. If you decide to play competitively, there are a few rules you might not think of during casual rounds, like marking your lie. And entering the sanctioned competitive domain requires all players to have at least a passing knowledge of the rules that govern regular play. The road to get a complete set of rules may never be over, but the work done in the late 70s and early 80s by some Hall of Famers laid the foundation for competition that we all enjoy watching today. I'm Gabe LeBounty. Join me once again as we explore the roots of flight. Developing rules for disc golf was a ton of work over the past 30 plus years to specifically define how our sport is played. And it was always done by committee. If not an official committee, then by the few individuals invested enough in the sport to realize compelling competition needs clear, established rules for all to abide by. Disc golf's historic first competitive event was the WAMO All-Comers Meet in 1967, but people from across the nation started coming together to flesh things out in the late 70s, starting with who else but Dan Stork Roddick, PDGA number 003, and the head of the International Frisbee Association at the time. As Stork tells it, there's something special about discussing rules in a sport where the administration is made up entirely of players.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing particularly about rules is that pretty much everybody loves them. Everybody loves them. And it's an ongoing problem with, let's say, something like the PDGA board. I mean, the PDGA board is a pretty disciplined operation with a lot of very buttoned up people, but throw up a rules question and it's like throwing red meat into a lion's cage. Everybody wants a part of that, you know, because we're all players and you could spend the whole night debating this one particular rule, and all pretensions of discipline of the board kind of go out the window when presented with, should we do this rule this way? Or what about videotaping? Should we have videotaping? Here's the lie, in or out. And you've got 9 people on the board. 9 different opinions, their experiences, well, there was this time, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all at once, the whole meeting is gone, arguing over this one question. That never happens on the IT side or some other thing like that. They just go, oh yeah, if the IT guys say it's good, it's good. But the rules committee, oh man, when it comes up, they're going, oh, well, wait a minute, I'm a player. Let's talk about this for about a half an hour. You know, I mean, it's everybody loves it.
Whether you're cursing a rule you and your buddies think doesn't belong, or if you're on the PDGA rules committee, everyone has an opinion about the rules. I don't know if we'll ever get to a place where the rules administrators are not also players, and honestly, I hope we don't. We've been doing a pretty good job so far, and when Stork started winding up competition through the IFA, he knew they had a monstrous task before them. Not only did they need to clarify the rules of disc golf, they were also setting regulations for all other Frisbee events played in overall competition, an era that started with an 8-event tournament in 1974, the same year as the American Flying Disc Open, where Stork won a car from Jim Palmieri.
That was the first octet. I mean, that was the time when we really had to deal with, when we were about to host this 8-event gathering in New Brunswick. And we had to sit down and say, okay, we know that they're playing MTA in Berkeley, and they have some, you know, cool little rules, like if it hits the light post, then it maybe adds more seconds, or I can't remember. They had simultaneous throw, which is a really cool format, where it's 2-1 throw, and then of course the last person, you don't even bother to time it. It's the last person to successfully catch is the winner. So we had to codify that because we were going to have that as one of our events. I don't think anybody had done throw, run, and catch before we did it. I could be mistaken on that, but I think the octet was the first to do that.
While they were using rules created by the people who played catch and invented games, when it came to disc golf, there were a few things to hammer out for Stork's inaugural overall competition, including a way more extreme version of the step putt and the establishment of the controversial 2-meter rule.
And then when we got to disc golf, I don't think that we had anything else to draw from. And so we at least said, these are going to be the rules for octet. And I remember specifically that we had things like, I was always one looking to put athleticism as much as I could into it. And this brings us to the step putt these days, that if there was a mandatory, and a lot of the holes had mandatories, because I was really focused on trying to have flight paths as opposed to just point A to point B. And so there were a lot of situations where you were just short of a mandatory. And so my theory was, okay, you should be able to, with disc in hand, run to the lie, plant as if you were taking off in broad jump, fly as far as you could, release before you landed, and that would be your play. And we're kind of going, I don't know, it seems kind of weird. Should we do that or shouldn't we? I can't even remember whether we did or not, but it was the first step putt, essentially. And then there was the whole argument with, it was a discussion, with Palmieri about the lie above ground, and that if you could put your foot on it, then it played. And Palmieri, who's, you know, 3'8" or something, is saying, that's not fair. So we had to, we just standardized it at 2 meters. We were just saying, okay, we want to do our best to write down all of the problems, potential problems that we can think of, so that we don't have those in play. And so that was the first time that I was looking at codifying all of those kinds of rules, essentially. So back at Octane.
The additions got interesting, and a lot obviously wasn't kept throughout the years. With the Octet happening shortly before Palmieri's AFDO, they had some early collaboration beyond Stork's original committee of three, and they took the quick turnaround as an opportunity to adapt moving forward, as well as getting some help from an early Frisbee legend.
Jimmy and his crew came down, and so I'm sure that we worked from what we had played there and said, okay, where did that fall short? And it's something I always give John Kirkland credit for, because the guy is so clever that I said he saved us months and months and months, because he could find any gap in rules, you know, and you discovered it that weekend, so you could fix it quickly. It might have taken years to fix it without John, but you go, oh man, John discovered that one gap there, and so we fixed that quickly. And so I think when we moved on to St. John Fisher College and AFDO, I'm sure it was based mainly on what we had put down initially for Octave.
These first two events resulted in quite a few more than the original 15 DGA rules. And even though they were able to crib from ball golf, there were always some advocating for fewer rules, despite constantly discovering new situations where older, simpler rules just couldn't apply.
But a lot of it is commonsensical. You know, I mean, there was a fellow around for years. I guess he's probably still around. He was a top senior player called Hoser. And Hoser was always into simplifying the rules. And even after we had started to get into very involved considerations, he said, Stork, you only need 10 rules. 10 rules. Anything more than 10 rules is noise. You know, 10 rules. That's all you need for the game. And so it is pretty straightforward, especially when you're cribbing off of our long established ball golf friends. There's only so many things. And then as we went along, of course, the nuance after that was just things that we discovered where there were gaps and said, well, what if, you know, you're leaning up against a building? I mean, where's your lie? And that kind of thing. So it really was just problem solving after the basic understandings.
After laying the foundation for clearer disc golf rules, Stork was moving on to the tournament series we heard about through episodes 1 and 2. To keep the sports moving forward, Stork knew he would need more manpower.
The next stage for me was... I'm coming out to San Gabriel and we're saying, let's start running national series events that are going to have all these events in. And so one of the first orders of business was, well, let's get these players committees going. And they were all the main movers and shakers. In each case, it was trying to select who the main mover was at that point, as opposed to having a fiefdom fight with some main mover about this. We were just looking to say, hey, let's codify these to our general satisfaction, because it's what we're going to be playing in these NAS meets.
Stork believed in keeping the band together from the very beginning, and knew all these emerging sports would collapse under the weight of major divisions in the ranks over issues like which organization's rules should be used. Some disciplines already had players' organizations going, or at least a network of players, and Stork was determined to leverage collaboration with the early pioneers to give the sports the biggest head of steam possible moving into the NAS era.
The goal was to have them be identical. And that's mainly because I had seen other sports and other activities that did not have that and ended up being kind of turf battles. I think maybe I mentioned that my dad and I rode BMW motorcycles, and we discovered that there were two BMW organizations, the BMW Riders of America and BMW Owners of America. And these two sets of BMW riders hated each other. You know, and I mean, you're going, what's the problem, guys? You know, we're all riding BMWs, okay? So we've already gotten over that. But they had conflicting plans and they wanted to fight over who was going to go to what rally. And then there's boxing, you know, where there were all these contending titles and said, hey, man, let's not do that. We're a small enough tribe right now. Let's make sure that we eliminate as many divisions as we can. And the trick to that, because things were so easily manipulated, was typically to, if I could, make the head of the non-IFA organization or non-WFDF, depending on the era, make them the head of the committee for IFA or WFDF. So it's hard for the person to fight with themselves. And so there we had the perfect sync of saying, okay, Blair Paulson is the head man in this area of PDGA, and he's also the chair of the WFDF committee. Done deal.
Stork built a lot in those earliest years, laying the groundwork with additions and changes to the rules. He does have one regret about not using his bully pulpit at the top of the IFA to simplify the process of marking your lie.
One of my major regrets, and I really don't have too many, but the particular one is that, of course, I had the perfect opportunity to make the foot placement and lie rule a lot simpler than it has been traditionally. And that is that instead of going through the whole process of there's your thrown disc. Okay, pull out this special marker mini, put it at the nose of the disc, then you can pick up your thrown disc, etc. Anytime you take a newbie out, you got to go through 5 minutes of that explanation. And whereas they think their lie is their thrown disc, what else would it be? I just threw it there. I guess I put my foot behind it, right? No. That's not how we do it. We mark it. So if I had my chance to go with Marty McFly back to 74, I would have simply said, it's your thrown disc. That's your marker. No need for any other equipment. Make your lie right behind it and play on.
Stork isn't advocating for completely doing away with marking your lie, just marking it at the back edge of your disc along the line of play. From a game perspective, it also makes more sense, since you don't have the opportunity to gain the, albeit negligible, distance from the back of your disc to the front. And Stork believes we'll get to it someday.
It's better theoretically, if you get really into it on a very specific basis of you really haven't earned that distance that is the diameter of your disc. You threw to there, here's your foot, you play. And it actually has been proposed to play thrown disc. And in fact, it's an option, obviously. You can play thrown disc. And you'll see even the pros often, I enjoy seeing that they just play it as it lies, essentially, and don't worry about that 6 inches or whatever that they gain. But it has been proposed by the rules committee, but traditionalists are so entrenched in, oh, it would take us, you know, we played this a long time like this. It would take us forever to explain it. I said, forever? People would learn it in a weekend, and a year from now, they wouldn't even remember that we used to do it that other dumb way.
If you laid the foundation for modern-day disc golf rules and you have only one major regret over a relatively minor rule, you're doing pretty well in my book. The modification of the original rules of play later fell to the player base via committee, but more pressing to Stork was the issue of tech standards and equipment discussed in Episode 4 of Season 1. At the time, weight of discs was the primary modification and gave disc golf players a good place to start asking questions about how much is too much when it comes to equipment.
But in terms of golf, that's where it gets a little fuzzy for me, because I know that we were making our decisions that we had to make for the NAS meets, and we weren't quite yet to Ed starting the DGA. And so there was a little bit of a vague period in there. But one of the things that was probably more important than the rules was in golf was the equipment. Because once we got to the point that Ed had left Wham-O and started DGA and was promoting tournaments. And we also had those tournaments as part of NES. We started to deal with that question of, well, what's legal equipment? People were learning how to make discs heavier and heavier, primarily Ed, putting more and more phosphorescence in them initially. Then that started to be brittle, and then discovering that barium in there would weight them up. So the discs were getting heavier and heavier, and people were going, well, how heavy are they going to be? You know, and how can I get the heaviest one that's available? Because everybody was pretty quickly learning that, man, weight is your friend when you're talking about a stock 119, and all at once the guy shows up with a 135. You're going, oh my God, the ultimate weapon. I mean, he threw that thing right into the teeth of the wind, and whew, my 119 was peeling off into the woods. You know, so that started to be kind of a more primary concern.
It wasn't until later in the 80s when the full range of technical standards, including weight, maximum diameter, and flexibility, were set in stone. But before Ted Smethers sent out his survey on what players thought the weight limit should be, with new golf discs popping up everywhere, Hedrick pulled his own network of pros to get a max weight limit for early Frisbees. He used the same measure of grams per centimeter, but it came out to significantly less than the current limit of 8.3 grams per centimeter, and much less than what players like Stork wanted.
I think Ed put out the first poll through his pros and friends, because I know I got a vote, where he said, okay, we're going to put a weight limit. Pick a number of grams per centimeter of diameter, and we'll take all of the votes of these, I don't know, 30 people or whatever. I will average them, and that will be our number, which I, as I recall, came out to 6.7. It was somewhere in there, that gram. Now, I know that he didn't do that, because, of course, I submitted infinity. And if that was in the formula, it couldn't have been done. But I think more reasonable people voted in that range.
About the same time as Hedrick was coming up with his 15-rule sign, Stork laid some of the broadest roots for rules to grow and feed the sport of disc golf. Rules revisions were made, but not well documented through the vague years of Hedrick forming the DGA and the PDGA, and Stork getting the IFA running. The PDGA has the 1982 rulebook accessible on their website from the groundwork laid on the East Coast in Brunswick, New Jersey, and Rochester, New York. And the year after the Innova Eagle/Arrow started a new era in disc golf, the PDGA World Championship came back to Rochester in 1984. Ted Smethers, PDGA number 1159, and the man who succeeded Hedrick in running the PDGA, saw way too many problems with the rules at this tournament, including the root of no one calling foot faults during play.
What do you do if we decide somebody's has committed a foot fault? You know, and if you read the rule at the time, you know, if you stepped on the line, technically that was a foot fault. You took a stroke and then throw again. Well, so and I remember watching the final round, the final foursome for the championship. They got the whole gallery and everything. And there was, I go, oh, that guy just foot faulted. You know, oh, that guy just foot faulted. And then just played on, you know, nobody said a word. And I was like, I'm not saying nothing. You know? Because it was silly, to be honest. Just because your foot was on the line, that's not a, you don't get a stroke for that, you know. And so, and it was usually somewhat of a fuzzy line anyway. It wasn't a mark on the ground that you could tell. But, where was it a penalty? Was it where your toe goes across the line, or where your whole foot has to be across the line? You know, that.
foot fault calls still seem few and far between in professional play, at least in what we see broadcast and post-produced. Another rule at the 1984 Worlds that players saw wasn't exactly clarified dealt with OB strokes and water hazards. On this, Ted leaned a little more toward the side of simplification.
You know, and I don't know what the current rule is for throwing your disc in the out of bounds or in the water. At that time, my position was, you know, if you don't like your lie, take a stroke. If your foot's in the water, if you're dressed in the water, you stick your foot in the water, right? You know, so soak it or stroke it.
Even if it is fun to say, I, for one, am glad for the sake of my socks that I don't have the option of stepping into a water hazard to save a stroke. Although this rule did have its advantages outside the water, and you can still see it used regularly by the pros today.
Yeah, I remember playing some tournaments in Oklahoma back in the day when plastic was light, and it's very windy in Oklahoma. I remember they put the pole on the knoll, little hill, you know, it's like a little out sitting right there at the peak, right in, and it was a gust, gale wind, force winds. And I remember putting into the wind, and the disc floated right up, kind of touched the chains, right? And then went, behind me about 50 feet, you know? And I was like, oh my gosh, it was horrible. Anyway, got to Rochester, and all kinds of issues came up. Foot faults, and just, you know, what if you lie in the waters, and where do you put your disc, you know, just on and on. And so there was just lots of discussion about the rules. We just kind of muddled our way through it in the match itself. Everybody held their nose and went on.
There was a litany of issue with the rules that Ted knew needed to be sorted out. And as head of the PGA, he appointed Tim Geib, PDGA number 1674, as the chair of the Rules Committee at the 1984 Worlds. But as Stork pointed out in the beginning, everyone has an opinion on the rules. In episode 5, we got a bit of the story about Ted's card ride back from that Worlds, and for this talk, he went into a bit more detail about how he and his friends planted the seed for the first major revision of the PDGA rules.
Bill Trousdale and his wife Lisa and Ace Mason rode together all the way from Arkansas to Rochester, New York. We picked up Ace from Kansas City, but that wasn't on the way, right? So he hitchhiked to St. Louis, and he says, I'll be at the such and such interstate, under some interstate bridge in St. Louis by such and such a time, and we determined we'd go through it. You know, this is before cell phones and everything. We're never going to find this guy. Sure enough, we're downtown St. Louis. There he is on the side of the interstate. Pulled over, and he jumps in. And I couldn't believe that worked out. Ace Mason, I never had so much fun at a disc golf event ever before or since as Ace and I had at that tournament in Rochester. We just had a ball. Drove straight through. Dropped Ace off on the interstate in St. Louis. So we started having this big discussion on the rules right away on the drive home. And at that time, Lisa was my secretary. So Ed was paying expenses, and I was the pro tour coordinator. And I'd hired Lisa on a part-time basis to type letters for me and do basic secretarial work. And I said, stop. Lisa, get out your notepad, and I want you to take notes. I'm going to start at the very beginning. We're going to go rule by rule, and we're going to discuss. We had lots of differences of opinion. And so we're going to write down everybody's opinion. We don't have to decide which opinion we think is correct at the present time. All we have to do is identify the issues and include the discussion of each issue. So if we get into an argument, which we had lots of, it's like, it's okay. Write that down. Release it. Wrote it down. She took notes, prodigious notes, and wrote it all down. And both sides of the argument, sometimes three sides of the argument, four sides. And Bill and Lisa participated, and it was mostly me and Ace. And so for eight, that was literally all we did for 18 hours. And you know, we kind of got through the rule book, then it was like, okay, what is not in here that needs to be in here? Well, that took 4 more hours, you know. And I think we just barely got it done. Yeah, literally, it's time to drop Ace off at the interstate. Okay, I think we're done. And so we got home, and I paid Lisa to type it up. I believe it was at Rochester that I appointed Tim Guybe to be over the rules. So I had her print it out. We stuck it in an envelope and mailed it to him. And never heard another word for a long time. Because I just, you know, rules were important. But I had other fish to fry. Yeah, we were starting building everything from scratch. Years later, I ran into Tim. And by that time, they had issued a new rule book. He said, oh, yeah, he says, that letter you guys sent was just put us light years ahead. We got, you know, it was a big, big, big help. Because, I mean, we had talked through all the issues. I'm sure it was very helpful to them.
The next edition of the PDGA rules came 2 years later in 1986 with about 350 revisions and 1,300 more words than the 1986 edition. The Rules Committee had a great starting point, thanks to the letter from Ted, Ace Mason, and the Trousdales. The discussions had on that marathon car ride gave initial arguments for and against revisions, saving the Rules Committee some of the early steps of figuring out what rules to change. I imagine the committee taking 2 years to parse through notes and recreate the rule book when Ted's letter only took 18 hours to draft had a bit to do with the finality of publishing.
And honestly,
rules.
I don't remember, you know, what we argued about or what we got passionate about. We just hammered through it. And it was important that we didn't have to decide. You know, that was upfront ground rule. We're not here to decide. That's the committee's job is to decide. Our job is to identify the issue, lay out the argument on both for, pro, and con, and move on. And I think we did an effective job of that.
The rules of disc golf have come a long way in the 30-plus years organized competition has been held. We went from a one-page sign sold with DGA courses in 1978 and the preliminary rules set down at the Octet and the Rochester Flying Disc Open in 1974 to the 8 pages of rules found as notes kept by Hedrick for the PDGA competition up to 1982 to the first major revision by the players in 1986. At this point, most of the rules had been added, and the next major revision in 1990 started the process of fleshing out, clarifying, and updating a rulebook maintained by the PDGA Rules Committee. The difficult work of discovering what rules needed to apply to disc golf was carried out in just the first few years of competition, and with a few exceptions like Ted's marathon ad hoc committee session on the 18-hour drive back from New York, there have mainly just been tweaks to the existing rules. I have no doubt that we would be playing a similar game if Hedrick, Stork, or Smethers had been more lax in fixing the problems they saw. We'd just be a bit behind. Their early work ensured competition grew in a more fun, fair, and compelling direction, and that discussion between Ted, Ace, Lisa, and Bill kickstarted the first real revision to the PDGA rulebook, putting it way ahead of its time. It comes up again and again in disc golf. The dedicated individuals planting seeds and tending to the soil so players today can reap the rewards. The rules of a game is never an easy topic to tackle. It's esoteric and requires experience in the game to really dive into the details, and given the 3 decades of revision, there's a broad pool of stories to pull from. I'll definitely be coming back to this subject in the future, not only to trace the revisions beyond the 1986 rulebook, but also to find the earlier stories that we can trace forward to our modern game. Close to the end of Season 1, and for the first 2 episodes of Season 2, I felt like I was finally getting to a point where I had more answers than questions after an episode instead of the opposite. But the topic of rules has brought even more questions that I hope you'll come and explore with me as we dive into the nitty-gritty of what made disc golf. Up next on Roots of Flight, we'll be moving from the early codification of rules of disc golf to exploring what the different frisbee disciplines had in common with disc golf, as well as what set disc golf apart from ultimate, freestyle, and the overall field events. Be on the lookout for episode 5 in your feeds after the holidays on Wednesday, January 5th. Be sure to tune in to Roots of Flight on the Disc Golf Network, where Brian Earhart and I discuss and take a bit of a deeper look at a few topics from each episode. For this episode, we'll be discussing the long history of not calling foot faults in disc golf, and how that long-standing problem might be solved in the future, as well as what disc golf might have looked like if we hadn't put so many regulations on the production of the golf disc. You can find that exclusively on the Disc Golf Network. If you aren't yet a DGN subscriber, you can become one today for as little as $3 a month if you're a PDGA member, which gets you access to this recap show, the 2021 Hall of Fame induction ceremony, an interview with Stork about Oak Grove Park, great shows like Scratch to Scratch, and all the live disc golf coverage of Elite Series events. This podcast was created, written, and produced by me, Gabe LeBounty, in consultation with Andy Young and Jeff Homburg, and is distributed by the Disc Golf Network. The logo is by Alyssa Ann. You can find her on Instagram, at InkWitchLiss. Roots of Flight is produced in collaboration with the Disc Golf Hall of Fame, with the shared goal of ensuring the rich history of the game is preserved for the future. To learn more about the Hall of Fame and how you can support their mission, please visit thediscgolfhalloffame.com. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on more of the story of disc golf. And if you like the show, leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. It would really help lead disc golfers to the history of the sport. You can find Roots of Flight on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever podcasts are sold. You can also find Roots of Flight on Twitter and Instagram, at RootsOfFlightDG, to catch announcements on new episodes, polls, and some interesting clips that don't quite make the final episodes. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at GrizzlyGingerDG. Join me here next time as we explore the roots of flight.